Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. Welcome to Species Unite, the podcast where we talk to people who are fighting some of the hardest fights on Earth to stop the unnecessary suffering of animals. Today's conversation is with Mike Wolf. Mike spent almost 4 years working undercover in factory farms. He has seen thousands of animals living in deplorable conditions and has witnessed abuse that I think few of us can even imagine. He's now director of investigations for the animal protection organization Compassion Over Killing. Since Mike and I met at his home in Arizona this spring, Compassion Over Killing has released another investigation. This time it was Martin Farms, a dairy farm in Pennsylvania that's a supplier for Nestle. The footage that they released is shocking, to say the least. It's absolutely horrible and really difficult to watch, but I beg you, watch it, pass it around. It's the only way change happens. And as hard as it is for us to sit through and watch these videos, think about the animals who are actually living through this. There's links to it on our website, as well as Compassion Over Killings, which is cok.net. Can you take me through where you started and how that happened?
Yeah, sure. And thank you. I grew up in Jersey. And growing up, I always loved animals. Had a cat and I had a dog and always very loving with animals, but never really knew too much about animal rights. I had heard about vegans. I had heard about vegetarians, heard about animal issues, but I never really thought about it. And then I went to Rutgers. Graduated with a degree in psychology. Then I was at a place where I think a lot of psych students end up, where you just have no clue what you're going to do with that. I was kind of bouncing around for a few years, different jobs. And then in October 2005, my dog Curly died. That was a very difficult time for me. I spent a lot of time trying to mourn and going through my grief and everything, and spent some time online looking up pet loss and just how to deal with it. And I came across information on dogs being slaughtered and eaten in other countries. I had heard about that before, but it was kind of more something in the distant, you know, part of my mind, just something I tried to block out. I was in this place where I'm sitting here mourning over Curly. I started to envision Curly like going through those situations. And had he been born in one of those countries, then he would have been hit and kicked and beaten and eventually eaten. That was really disturbing for me. But then I was still turning around and eating chicken and tuna and everything else. That was in October of 2005. And then within a couple of weeks, I decided that I wanted to stop eating animals and do something to help them. A couple months after that, I was working in the field undercover.
What was your first job?
When I first went into the field, it was for PETA.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so this was at a zoo.
Did you have any experience whatsoever like with walking into this?
No.
Okay. I'm just want to see like what the shock value was for you.
Very, very big shock value okay. In a lot of ways. It was my first time really traveling past the East Coast. I was in the Midwest. It's a culture shock in the middle of small town nowhere. Yeah, so start working undercover, go into a zoo, and I was working with big cats and bears. I just felt like I was plucked out of my life and dropped into this like totally weird twilight zone. The job itself was really intense. It was like 6 days a week, long hours. Everyone walking around had guns on their hips.
What was your actual job at the zoo?
Feeding and cleaning the cats and bears.
On day one, you went in with cameras on you?
It took me a little time to bring the camera into this facility. But yeah, after a little while, then I was. And it stokes your paranoia a lot.
I was going to ask.
You know, you're constantly looking around. You're always just evaluating all of the different interactions that you're going through and all the different people you're talking to and how they're looking at you, if they're, you know, looking at you suspicious. You just want to be a step ahead of that if you start to get any kind of strange vibes from them.
And did PETA have reasons for you to go here? I mean, was there already a bad thing happening at this zoo?
Yeah. At the time, they were calling themselves a sanctuary. Then they ended up, after our investigation, they came out as a zoo because they were breeding. So this investigation was in 2006. At the end of last year, I think it was like October, November, I can't quite remember now, the owner actually was just arrested by an undercover FBI person for putting a hit on someone in the animal welfare community.
That's the whole undercover world. There's so many aspects of it. I don't think anyone really thinks about it unless they really talk to someone who's been in it. Because not only are you doing a usually incredibly hard job itself all day long, and doing things you don't want to be around, it's completely against your ethics. And you're also paranoid. There's so many things going against you in terms of just staying sane through this.
There really are. And I mean, it's, you have to be able to find your way to cope with it. I mean, I think there's, you know, that aspect. And the thing is that a lot of people demonize the workers in factory farming, for example. And at Compassion Over Killing, we just focus strictly on factory farming. But the fact is that most of these workers, a very high percentage of them, they're just your everyday people. They're just trying to do their job and put food on their table. There are definitely going to be those bad apple people, like the owner of the zoo, for example. But that's more of a rarity.
So just to finish the zoo, what did you find out?
Well, one of the bigger things was that they weren't feeding them. There were a lot of times, a lot of weeks that we were feeding the cats twice a week. And then we had to put in the USDA book that they were being fed six times a week. And just a lot of suffering. They'd left a lot of animals suffering without vet care, without any kind of medication.
And so, for instance, like with this investigation, does it come out that you were the undercover person when the reports come out?
The people at the facility will always know it was you, just based on like the footage. They'll be able to put it together based on who you're filming and what the situations are.
You went from the zoo to what was next?
I worked at a couple companion animal places. Main one was a no-kill facility that was actually a hoarding facility. They had several hundred dogs, several hundred cats who had never left for years and years.
It's amazing, too, that all these places need undercover people in them, because it's like the bad stuff is across the board. It's happening in so many different industries.
Everywhere. And that's the thing, like the only way for the public to see what's really happening is through undercover footage. I've been in facilities when there have been inspections. We've had other investigators in places where there have been inspections. And even when they're quote unquote unannounced, people know that they're happening. They're always announced. They have time to prep for it. Everybody knows, all the workers there know who the inspector is as they're walking through. And this is no matter what, if it's government inspections in a plant, nobody is going to hit an animal when you know there's an inspector walking right behind you.
When was your first time in a slaughterhouse?
I worked at a chicken slaughter plant, mainly on hog farms. I was on three different hog farms. Aside from investigation footage, the only view into animal agriculture the public has are the advertisements. There's this huge disconnect between what the industries and the government, because there's a lot of lobbying and the government has a hand in animal agriculture. So there's a huge disconnect between what they are putting out there, these idyllic images of these animals and pastures and big red barn and grass and sun, and what's actually happening.
Your first time going into a pig factory farm, were you prepared? How did you feel?
I was sort of prepared. I had an idea. I had watched videos. I had been told about it. I had talked to some of my colleagues. But no matter what you're told, no matter what you watch, nothing will ever prepare you for when you actually step foot into a place like that.
What were your jobs?
I was in breeding sites. So on a hog farm, you have breeding and farrowing. The breeding side is where you're artificially inseminating the pigs. You're moving them around to different areas and different crates. When they get time to close to farrow, and farrowing is when a pig gives birth, then you move them into the farrowing room, and then the farrowing employees will take over from there. The sow will give birth, and then the employees, they'll, you know, process all the piglets.
Will you talk about the piglets and what they go through?
The accepted method to kill a piglet who is either sick or injured or just too small or discolored is called thumping. And what they do, they hold them by their hind legs, swing them over their head, and just slam them headfirst into the concrete. That's the accepted method.
The legal method.
The legal method, yeah. It's often done improperly. It often takes several hits. The employees will swing them into the ground several times. It's very brutal. People are just slamming animals headfirst into the ground. People are doing this every day. They're doing it right now on hog farms all across the country, all across the world. But if it was happening to a puppy, someone would be put in jail.
And they're castrated?
The male pigs are castrated, no anesthesia. They just slice into their scrotum, rip the testicles right out. These standard practices, to me, are the worst part of animal agriculture. You have people who are punching and kicking these animals. To me, these body mutilations without any pain relief are way worse than being punched. A castration or debeaking, dehorning, those kinds of activities that happen every day.
Will you talk about those too as well?
Yeah. So debeaking happens to birds who are going to be layer hens. And so they essentially just cut off with a hot blade, and they do it in a few different ways, the tip of their beak. and there's a lot of sensitive nerve endings there. And so it's very painful for them. A lot of times birds will die of starvation or dehydration afterwards just because of the effects of it. That's done without any pain relief, dehorning or disbudding of calves on dairy farms. Very painful for them. Again, there's sensitive nerve endings in where their horns are. And there's, you know, different methods on how they do it, but basically they'll take a hot iron and they'll just kind of like burn it off.
It's got to just feel so painful to watch.
Yeah.
The animal in that much pain.
It is. And it's so unnecessary. For dehorning, for example, there are a genetic strain of cattle called polled cattle where they don't even grow horns. So if they were to use this genetic strain, they wouldn't even need to dehorn them. So there's an easy alternative to reduce that pain and suffering, and they're just not doing it.
Okay, so you're this guy from Jersey, and now you've done a lot of undercover. Do you go apply for a job? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, you're just going and applying like normal. Then you have to, you start working at these facilities, and you have to perform all the job duties that go along with that. So any of the standard practices, I mean, that's definitely the worst part, having to participate in those practices. You're essentially just any other worker, and you happen to have a camera, and you're just documenting what you're seeing as well.
There's got to be a bigger level of paranoia, I would think, of getting caught or being found out.
There definitely is. I mean, I think each investigator deals with it differently. For me, it was always in my mind. You kind of get into this place where I used to call it investigator mode. Like I just kind of get into this place where, you know, you focus on what you need to focus on. That just kind of helps you get through. You're more focused on, you know, the animals and what's going on with them and, you know, doing your job at the plant, but doing your actual job and making sure that, you know, because you're there to tell these animal stories. So you want to make sure that you're doing that.
So, but while you're doing your job, right, and you see someone kicking the crap out of a cow's face, so are you still like trying to angle yourself to, oh, I should be filming that?
If there's something going on, I mean, definitely that is something that is in your mind and to try to, you know, make it work to be able to film. And not just like the punching and kicking, like those kinds of abuses, but the standard practices.
How much footage do you need? Because it's still really hard to prosecute or convict any of these people, right?
It depends on the situation. And prosecuting, we've actually had a number of investigations these past few years where we have gotten criminal convictions. The thing that matters the most is just who you're approaching, the local area, the law enforcement, how seriously they're going to take it. We can have the best evidence of cruelty and it won't get charged. And then we can have something that, you know, obviously still cruelty, but maybe not as strong, and then get charges on that in a different area.
It's also really complicated. And I read something where you said, and this is kind of an aside, but it's connected, where you said, well, there's so much abuse, the non-legal abuse, the kicking and punching and prodding, and because there's so much legal abuse that abuse just becomes the norm.
Definitely, yes. I strongly believe that. If you're talking about castration, for example, you have someone who it's not only legal, but it's their job. In order to put food on their table for their family, they have to go in every day and slice the testicles off of pigs. I think it kind of creates a bit of a mind warp in these workers. And when you're doing that day in, day out, every day, hours and hours every day, all of a sudden punching and kicking doesn't seem so bad. And honestly, it's not. I would rather be punched a million times than to be castrated. So it's, you know.
No, I've never heard anyone put it like that, but it's true.
Yes, it really, like the punching to me pales in comparison to any of the body modifications,
well,
the body
mutilations. Well, what's legal.
Right, to what's legal. When you have all these pressures that these companies and the industries are putting on the workers to move faster, that's where, like when they're trying to move animals or, you know, large animals when you try to move them, or like birds when you're trying to catch them, or, you know, whatever it is, that's where a lot of that punching or kicking or abuse happens, because the animals are not doing what you want them to do. After you've castrated this animal, how bad is it to punch them, you know?
Right.
So,
and
yeah.
They're going to get their throat slit next week anyway.
Exactly. I think that all of the legal standard practices the animals go through are way worse and create more of the illegal abuses, which are more likely to get charged.
But to get convictions, you need the illegal.
Yeah, and it really, there's so many factors involved. One of our Tyson investigation in 2016, we actually were able to get a conviction on a standard practice.
How?
We're able to get like over 20 convictions on almost 10 workers, I think. We discovered this practice called boning. This was broiler breeder birds who were investigating. So these are the birds who were breeding the birds who were then going to become chicken flesh that people eat. Broilers typically are slaughtered around 45 days old. They're genetically modified to grow really obese, really fast. Their legs, their hearts, their lungs, I mean, their bodies cannot keep up with the weight. A lot of them, they go through all these crippling deformities. So in order to keep the breeders alive longer, because they keep them alive for a couple of years, when typically they're being slaughtered at 45 days, they put these plastic pieces called bones through their noses. And that prevented them from sticking their heads inside of some of the feeders. So it restricted their feed. So essentially they were keeping them in a state of perpetual starvation. They would stick the plastic piece through one nostril, come out the other. It was very painful for the birds. So our investigation exposed us for the first time. It actually led to not only a conviction for the practice of boning, but also ended the practice of boning, essentially. Before we went public with the investigation, law enforcement went to Tyson and they wanted answers. There was so much egregious cruelty going on there. And Tyson knew how bad this was going to look. So before we even went public, I think it was the day before, they actually announced publicly that they were stopping boning. Millions of birds who will not have to go through that process now. That set off a domino effect. And I think Purdue was the next one. Three or four other major chicken companies announced that they were going to stop because of the investigation. We actually went to trial. So this is the first time there were trial for breeder birds or broiler birds. And then from that point, everyone else pled. And so one of the convictions was for boning is the first time that there's been a conviction for a standard practice.
It sets a new precedent. And when there are charges, is it usually the workers that are charged or is it the higher ups?
For the most part, it's going to be workers who get charged, and essentially the companies throw them under the bus. I mean, ideally the companies would be charged and held accountable, but the companies have billions of dollars behind them and they can, you know, they spin it in a PR fashion and then they throw the workers under the bus. They act like they had no idea. They act like, you know, this is all going to change. But the reality is that the same exact thing is happening on every other farm that's in their supply chain. And they know that. They just want to try to save their, you know, customer base.
But I guess what does happen to the companies is it gets out.
Yes.
And it's becoming more public knowledge to people outside of the animal world.
Definitely. That's like one of the most important things, the public awareness of it. So there's kind of two different ways to attack the animal agriculture problem. And there's the animals who are there now, which is trying to reduce their suffering, and then vegan outreach. So trying to reduce the future generations of animals, the amount of animals who are going to go through it. So in that respect, the public awareness and education is our biggest method to help reduce the amount of animals. The vast, vast majority of people have no clue what's happening. And once they become aware, they're just shocked and horrified.
I mean, especially in the past 5 years, it feels like things are shifting.
Oh, definitely. When I first went vegetarian into the field and then vegan, it was 2006. So like, 13 years. In that time, the difference from then until now, it's mind-blowing. And when you're talking about like the vegan items in stores and restaurants, the amount of vegan products, the amount of vegan cheese. I mean, you go to the vegan cheese aisle now and it's just compared to what it was back then.
Even what it was 2 years ago,
yeah.
It's like, it's massive.
I know, it's amazing. The changes in public perception, that it's becoming more mainstream. You have more celebrities and athletes who are promoting it and going plant-based or vegan. When someone like Beyonce is promoting veganism, that is the most amazing thing in the world.
And that's what we need.
Yes.
More and more of that.
Definitely.
You spent 4 years undercover in factory farms?
About half in factory farms and half in other areas.
And you didn't lose your mind? I would think it's so hard not to just be severely depressed.
I've definitely dealt with issues through the years. And, you know, I've kind of come to a place actually semi-recently where I'm focusing a lot more on self-care. It's vital. I have dealt with depression. I have dealt with anxiety. I have PTSD. It's something I deal with every day. You have to have a good grasp on your coping mechanisms. You have to know how to deal with your stress. You can't just let it build up. And I mean, it's easy to say, it's harder to do.
Well, especially I would think, I mean, self-care actually does take energy and time. Mm-hmm. And when you're in
a factory farm or a slaughterhouse for the whole day, you know, day after day after day. It's not like you have all this time to like go get a massage and then go to therapy.
Absolutely. So when you're in the field, you're in this mode of like, you're able to just like, you have to, so you just kind of like bury it. And in like, when you're actually in a farm or a plant and you're surrounded by all your workers, like there's no way you can't express it. You have to bury it.
You have compartmentalized.
Yes, you absolutely have to. Like if you can't, then you're not going to be able to do the job. There were times when, yeah, I would go for massage, right? Like my, in the field, and even now, my main coping mechanisms were lifting and riding.
Right. So that's weights and motorcycles.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, sorry. I had, those were my main methods. And, you know, I brought my first bike around with me in the field and I would go for rides on off days. I've recently, actually, Compassion Over Killing has started working with this really amazing mindfulness meditation teacher, Nirali Shah. Uh-huh. So we have these sessions with her like once or twice a month. And we do meditation and then we'll also do just these teachings. The teaching part is more what resonates with me, just listening to what she's saying and, you know, the perspective that she has. The meditation part, if it's guided, that helps. But for me, it's hard to just meditate. Like to me, my meditation is like lifting, like that'll help clear my head. You can't delve into that in the field. You have to keep it boxed off. You have to, or else it's going to eat you up.
And I'm sure after the day, you just want to like check out and sleep.
Depending on the place you're in, you could be on site 10, 12, 14 hours. It could be 6 or 7 days a week. One of the hog farms I was at was 12 days on, 2 days off. You had every other weekend off. And those kinds of hours doing manual labor, you get back and you still have a few hours of work to do at night, reviewing your footage. So, I mean, if you have a long day and you're on site 14 hours and you have 3 hours of work to do afterwards, you could be working 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's your life. You have to get immersed in it. You essentially put your entire life on pause.
Well, I'm sure you're not really talking to many people in your real life.
Not anyone, but like for my investigators now, like, yeah, I'll talk to them. I'm their main, point of contact. But yeah, people back home, family, friends, you lose contact with people.
It's really heroic work. And if you guys weren't doing this kind of stuff, nothing would ever change and nothing would ever be out there and literally no one would know anything.
Right. And thank you. I mean, I do feel like investigations work is the biggest tool that we have because it feeds everything else, like welfare reforms or, you know, vegan outreach, like anything that we're able to do for the animals. I mean, it comes from information gathered, either video or photos or whatever it is, the data that's gathered from an investigation. If we didn't know what was happening, we wouldn't know what we could fight for or what we need to fight for.
Right. Now you're training and recruiting investigators.
Recruiting and managing them. And then, I go through a very lengthy recruitment process, really just to make sure that they're right for it.
There's not many people who could probably do this work, I would think.
Not many at all, no. It's very difficult to find the right person. You have to be able to pick up and leave at a moment's notice, go anywhere for any amount of time. You don't know when you're going to be back home. So either they can't do the traveling, or the biggest thing is the standard practices. If you're compassionate towards animals, you're not going to want to have to kill animals.
Or inflict pain.
Castrate them, inflict pain. Right. So that cuts out a very large portion of the applicants. It is difficult to find the right person. But when you do, it's...
When you were in the factory farms, when those investigations came out, like the Hormel one, does it come out that it was you? Like they knew it was you after?
Right? Yeah. Like, so the people at the facility, yeah, they're always going to know.
So your lifespan's pretty short, even if you don't want it to be in terms of being identified.
Yeah. It's always like, you mean just the amount of time you could spend
in the
field.
How much undercover you can do.
Yeah. It's always, the thing is like, it's so hard that there's a short life on it no matter what. There are people who are, you know, in the field for years and years, and there are people who are in the field for a year or two. And it just really depends on the person. And, you know, I've always, when I was in the field, I always knew when my time comes, I'll know. And my body will tell me, my mind will tell me, my heart will tell me I can't take it anymore. And I think that, you know, it's different for everybody. And sometimes people will put like a time expectation on themselves. Like they'll say, all right, I want to do this for 3 years. I'm like, well, don't even think about that. Think about the investigation you're in right now. And you have no idea how this is going to impact you in 6 months from now. There's always going to be a short amount of time people can spend in the field.
the people that you've recruited who are in the field now, you're their main point of contact. Mm. You're who they talk to every day.
Right.
You're holding a lot, I would think.
Yeah, it brings me back a lot. There's a lot of things that'll bring me back to my time in the field. And I think that that's really good. Like, it helps me mentor them and kind of walk through different situations. It's kind of a double-edged sword, because like, it's good. And then on the other hand, it is something that I deal with on a daily basis. You know, I left the field because my time was done. There's no way I could handle it anymore. And I live with it every day. But the thing is that I would live with it every day, whether I talked to them and saw the footage or not. Like, it's already in me. So there's no way to turn that off. Like, once you see it, and, you know, and it's all of your senses. Like, it's, you're there, and, you know, the sounds you hear on the video are different than the sounds you're going to hear in person. In person, the emotion you hear in their voices, you see it in their eyes, the smells. Oh my God, the smells of a chicken plant or a factory farm or a hog farm. It takes your breath away. It's so horrible. Like, even after I left the hog farm, like when the job ended, I stunk for probably about a week and a half afterwards.
Wow.
You cannot get that smell off of you. It's horrible.
And the people that work there, for real, work there. Do you become, while you're there, are you kind of become buddies with them?
Depends on the place. Sometimes, yes. And there definitely is the aspect of, yeah, building that a friendship, or, you know, feeling bad about that. And it's something that you do experience, you know, like, not all the time, and not for all the workers. If there's workers who are more violent or more egregious, then, you know, you definitely don't feel that. And you feel good being able to document what they're doing and bring it to the public and bring it to law enforcement.
For you, a big part of that, especially while you were in, and I think now too, right, was weightlifting.
Yes.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
Lifting was one of the things that just always helped me through. It's therapeutic. It's therapy, really. So after I got out of the field, I took a couple years away and needed some time just to kind of emotionally and mentally decompress. And then I got involved with an organization called Plant Built. They're basically a vegan fitness team competing in a variety of sports: bodybuilding, powerlifting, CrossFit. We go and compete as a team against non-vegans, and just basically just to show that vegans can compete at the same or a higher level.
And so, just for people who are interested in becoming vegan that aren't, but are worried about muscle and protein and all the myths out there, what was your lifting like pre being vegan and post?
So lifting didn't change. Before being vegan, I was on a very high protein, heavy, lean meat type of diet. So a typical day for me, breakfast was egg whites, could be a dozen egg whites for breakfast. Lunch was either one or two cans of tuna. And dinner, a lot of times I was eating a whole rotisserie chicken. So very high protein, heavy meat oriented, disgusting.
Now, that's crazy to think about.
When I look back on it, just disgusting. I can't believe I ate 365 chickens a year sometimes. Back then it was more bodybuilder style lifting. I was lifting anywhere between 5 and 7 days a week. After going vegan, it's really just a matter of finding the right things to eat that work for you. Now I don't necessarily care as much in my older age. I don't really care as much about protein. But for a while, even after being vegan, I still subscribe to the old school lifting method of 1 gram per body pound.
It's a lot of protein.
Yeah, it was. I was counting. I was keeping track. As long as I hit 200 grams, I considered it okay. And then I didn't care. Like, I tried to aim between 200 and 250. But once I hit 200, I stopped counting for the day. It definitely is a lot. Now I don't even really pay attention to it. My lifting being vegan I've been lifting way more than I was before I was vegan. And I mean, I don't know if it's just being older, the amount of time lifting, the amount of training and everything or not. But I mean, the veganism had no impact, decline at all. I mean, if anything, it's definitely a positive impact. I mean, my recovery time is shorter. I have more energy.
And one last thing I want to ask you about before we go. Will you talk a little about ag gag laws? Because I don't think a lot of people understand them or even know what they are. And the fact that they exist is just so insane.
It really is. So ag gag. So these are laws that certain states put into place basically to criminalize undercover investigations. They are unconstitutional laws. They are an infringement on our First Amendment rights. They violate free speech. There have been about five states, who enacted it, North Carolina, Iowa, Missouri, Utah, and Idaho. In recent years, Utah and Idaho have both overturned them. A federal judge declared them as unconstitutional. Recently, Iowa overturned theirs, and then they signed a new one into law afterwards. So they target animal rights activists. And so one provision is saying that you can't film in a facility. Another provision says you can't misrepresent yourself at all. So if you are connected to an animal rights organization, then, you know, that's misrepresentation. Another provision is, and this is the one that is the most, I think, cunning of them, where it says that you have to report cruelty within, say, 24 hours. Well, they're doing that because in order to go to law enforcement to build a case and to show, you know, a pattern of cruelty, we're not going to report it in 24 hours. You know, we'll report it to the supervisor. Well, we do report it to management on the farm. We take proper steps we need to there. But, you know, it takes time to build a case and go to law enforcement. So there are these different provisions that they put into place, which essentially criminalize what we do. And so it's absurd when you think about the fact that these laws are being passed. And you have to take a look at the states. Like Iowa is number one in pork production. They're number one in egg production. Those industries create a lot of money for the state. There is a very incestuous relationship between animal agriculture and the government. You have a lot of high-level executives going back and forth between meat industry and USDA. They help each other. And there's lobbyists, and you know they're passing these laws in order to protect. The government is protecting the animal agriculture industries. They are passing laws to stop people from knowing what is happening in the production of their food. So it's not just the animal treatment, which to me, that's obviously the most important thing, but you're also talking about food safety. We've discovered in different investigations, our Superior Farms investigation, we discovered Best Buy date labels were being changed, extended by up to 15 days to make it appear fresher. We had in our quality pork processors investigation, we documented pigs carcasses with the thick oozing pus and feces all over them going down the line to be processed into the food supply. So it's not just animal welfare, or animal treatment, it's also food safety. And the government is passing laws to stop people from knowing what's happening. It's absurd. People who are working there, they know that there's no threat to them. They could do whatever they want, however they want, and they're quote unquote just animals. And there's no repercussions. There's no accountability. We are the only ones who are being able to go in and hold these groups, these companies accountable.
And that's the crazy thing to me too, is that we don't have anybody enforcing this except for animal rights groups, right? And like, if you guys didn't exist, it's a free-for-all of just like violence, abuse, and how fast can we do this?
Exactly.
I mean, it already is, but it would be more so.
Much worse, yeah. And I mean, the only thing that matters is the bottom line to these companies. So yeah, if they knew that they didn't have to, you know, contend with our investigations when they come out, I mean, I couldn't even imagine the way it would be now. It would just be, it would just be a complete free-for-all. Even now, it is. I mean, anywhere we go in, I feel like these places have the invincibility mentality where they feel like it'll never happen to me. Like they're aware that there's animal rights groups. They're aware of undercover investigations. The amount of times that when I was in the field, I personally heard and other investigators, like I'll see footage coming in where someone says, oh, there's nobody from PETA here. Or, oh, if there was an animal rights person here filming or, oh, blah, blah, blah. Like they're aware of it. They will make comments like that.
Right.
But they just don't ever think it'll happen to them.
Yeah. And in terms of how people who don't actually really even know a lot of this is happening, but when they do learn and people see your videos and look at Compassion Over Killing's website and see all the incredible work you guys do, aside from going vegan, which is the good answer, what can people do?
Yeah, and that's an awesome question. And so there's, you know, a couple things. Obviously, number one thing, go vegan. Have to say that. Number two is reducing animal products. So for people who will not just go vegan overnight, and there are a lot of people who just can't, you know, and it's something that people have to come to it. You have to meet them where they are. They have to come to it in their own way. If you force them or if it goes too fast, then there is a much higher recidivism rate. So just reducing the amount of animal products. Whenever we release an investigation, we get flooded with messages from the public of people just saying that they are just so shocked and they had no idea and they are so thankful that we exposed this. And now they're going to go vegetarian or vegan. And I think that's really telling to the fact that the average person really has no clue what's happening. So really just spreading the awareness as much as possible, helping to share the investigations, you know, really to as many people as you can is a really the other really great thing you can do.
Thank you so much, Mike. This has been really eye-opening, this whole conversation. So thank you.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Like I said at the beginning of the episode, Compassion Over Killing has recently released an investigation of Martin Farms in Pennsylvania. They're a supplier for Nestle. The videos are really hard to watch, but watch them and share them. They are on Compassion Over Killing's website, cok.net, and our website, speciesunite.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And we're on Patreon, so if you feel so inclined to support the podcast, it'd be greatly appreciated. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review because it helps people find this show. Thanks again for listening to Species Unite. I would like to thank everybody who made today's episode possible, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Anna Kollner, and a special thanks to Allison Behringer. Thanks again. Have a wonderful day.